It's Central Time. I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, despite dairy farms falling on tough times, the big county dairy breakfasts continue in Wisconsin. We'll look at why they're such an important part of the farming community.
First, if you've ever felt like you're spacing out a bunch or just not feeling very creative, perhaps your attention span is playing a role.
There's a lot these days competing for our attention, not least of which are our phones. And even when we're not looking down at them, we're often checked out of the habits that help us spark creativity, inspiration, and even joy.
Our next guest says it's time to slow down and notice the world around us. Rob Walker is the author of The Art of Noticing. Rob is a journalist and columnist who covers a variety of subjects from design, tech, business, and the arts. He's also an advice columnist for lifehacker.com. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So your book is titled The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. From your perspective, what exactly aren't we noticing?
Well, I mean, I think it's the small things, right? I think you don't have to spend too much time, convincing people that we're in this moment of kind of just nonstop cultural distraction. And, you know, you mentioned technology at the top, and that's the first thing that people about is, oh, my phone is ringing all the time. But it's really kind of human nature to want to be paying attention to what everyone else is paying attention to, and technology just makes that much easier now to know what the trending topics are and to zero on that, which takes you out of the present moment and maybe noticing the small things that no one else is paying attention to and finding what's interesting and compelling to you about that.
Rob, we're going to go ahead and reconnect our phone connection with you because we're having a little bit of a hard time hearing you. We want to make sure that we hear everything that you have to say. So I'm going to ask our call screener just to reconnect with you. And while we're doing that, listeners, we're going to ask you for your perspective on this. Do you find yourself getting distracted in day-to-day life? How do you make time just to slow down and appreciate the details in the world around you? Have you noticed your friends, family, maybe yourself just spending too much time staring at your phone? And what do you doing about it? We're going to take your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We know we're saying, hey, you know, put the phones down, appreciate the world around you, and we're asking you to call in. But at least you won't be texting. You won't be distracted. It'll just be up to your face. And, you know, one of the tips that Rob shares in his book is that, you know, spend some time just sitting and looking at a piece of art and spend more time than you would think doing it. And you'll notice details that, you know, perhaps you didn't see before. So maybe if there's a really sweet picture in your house or a great window, spend some time looking out of that while you give us a call.
And we are back with Rob Walker. He is the author of The Art of Noticing. He's also an advice columnist for lifehacker.com. Rob, thanks for rolling with us. And before we reconnected, we were talking about just the world around us and why noticing is important. And, you know, from your perspective, you know, what was the spark, the inspiration that, you know, went off in your head that said, you know what, I really want to put pen to paper and share this with the world?
Sure. So it's a great question because it kind of goes to the way that I answer this in general, is that I started out being more interested in the problem, basically, and thought that I was going to, I spent a couple of years thinking about a book about, like, oh, all the things we're missing out on in kind of a negative way. And I was going to have sort of 10 pages at the end saying, and here are some suggestions for little exercises you can do that will help bring a positive sense of noticing back into your life. And I finally realized I didn't want to write the first 290 pages. I just want to write the last. So I made it the whole book. That's why there's 131 of these kind of exercises or prompts or provocations, just small things, because I really do want to position this not as all the things you're missing out on, but rather as all the things you can discover if you just add this kind of practice to your daily existence. I'm not anti-technology. I'm very frustrated by the prescriptions that sort of involve, oh, you need a digital detox, you need to throw your phone away, you need to delete all these apps. No one's really going to do any of those things. It's not really very helpful to suggest that. But instead, if you can do things like, on your way to work, notice something new every day. Just make it a game. It's a simple game. It adds to your life. It doesn't take anything away from anything. And it adds some texture. Who knows what you'll discover? It's mind opening. It's kind of, you know, we need these sort of mindful breaks from being assaulted by everyone else's desires on our attention. So it's that kind of approach that led me to write the book.
Rob, I think the moment that I really connected with your book is when you were talking about just looking for, you know, something a little bit different. And for you, you kind of got started with looking at security cameras. And, you know, so my experience was, I bought a house a couple of years ago. And before that, I don't think I ever really looked at people's roofs. And now, like, being a homeowner and living in constant fear that the roof is going to fall in or something's going to happen to it, I'm looking at everybody's roof. And so I kind of get where you're coming from. But talk about where this idea came from to look for security cameras in particular.
Sure. The roof thing sounds a little stressful to me, if I may say so. But
I probably need something else.
The security camera thing came about because of a trip I was taking to San Francisco, a city I like a lot, but I've been to a lot. And I was going to not have time to do any real sightseeing. And I just wanted to give myself basically an assignment, a looking assignment. Just look at something. And my only parameter was look for something that no one wants you to look for, right? Because so much of your time is spent reacting to people trying to capture your attention. And I picked security cameras for no real reason, but it ended up being this really fun game to spot them everywhere. Notice the different types, notice how they're used. In some situations, they sort of want to call attention to themselves, and some situations, they're kind of almost disguised. And I can tell you that now that I've been out with the book, I still look for security cameras, and now I get people emailing me pictures of security cameras all the time.
Which is what I'm sure you really wanted in the first place.
I don't need any more of those, but thank you for everyone. But anyway, it was an early example of how you can kind of just gamify the everyday world, and it changes your perspective, and it gives you sort of a different, like, sort of shift in how you're looking at the world that has kind of weird, unexpected payoffs.
So you're talking about that shift in perspective by noticing just one thing and then seeing it kind of everywhere around you. How has that shift, I guess, shifted into other parts of your life?
Well, so as a journalist, and I write about this, so I've ended up writing a number of things about security cameras. But, you know, you're always looking for, look, this is, so I also teach a little bit of design, and this is a core competency of designers is noticing things that other people have overlooked, right? So that they can spot a problem or see an opportunity. And if you think about it, that general approach is applicable in many professions where you want to be the one who, let's say you're being an entrepreneur, let's say you're being a manager, a coach, you're always looking for that one differentiating thing that everyone else has missed. And you can never get to that by following the pack. The whole point is to try to notice the thing that breaks from the pack. You know this as being connected to the world of journalism, that there's literally the term pack journalism that is the thing you don't want to be a part of. You want to be doing the one thing that that everyone else missed, but is that has the story and that's hidden in it that's going to make you stand out.
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, we in the media spend so much time thinking about what's the next big idea? How can we push things even further? You know, what's the next thing? And then we stop and we miss the fact that the solution is often right there in front of us. And you point to several examples of successful people who really took advantage of that and have made a lot of money discovering something that was right in front of our faces all along. Can you share some of those success stories?
Well, some of the ones that I tend to mention, I mean, just to jump around a little bit, but obviously Warren Buffett's success is in, you know, he is not someone who chases the hot stock. He's the one who coldly analyzes the stuff that everyone else missed and has done all right by that strategy, I would say. But in sports, Billy Beane, the manager of the Oakland A's, sort of created, or the general manager, I guess, who was paid attention to these statistics that no one else was paying attention to. Rachel Carson invented the modern environmental movement by noticing, toxins that other people were not only ignoring, but actively trying to hide. Artists are really good at this. John Cage and Marcel Duchamp, among others, have found things, whether it was Duchamp with the signing a urinal and declaring it to be a work of art. Changing boundaries between what is worth our attention and what isn't, what is art and what isn't.
I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Nikki in Delavan. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
And what did you want to talk about?
Mine was more towards the nature aspect. I had moved in with my boyfriend about a year ago, and I noticed that he had a herd of chipmunks in his backyard. I just find them very cute. They're very fascinating. And I actually found myself leaving my phone on my charger every morning because they become kind of like my alarm clocks since they're kind of used to me seeing them now. And I found that there's like more than three of them, and I see them coming out of different corners out of our deck and out of the bushes and around the house. And I just found myself, again, spending more time just sitting outside or staring out my window, not only watching them, but I guess just taking in nature as itself and just realizing, you know, there's so many different things and animals on this planet that we still don't know a lot about. But if we just pay just a little bit of attention to them every day, you can find a lot.
Nikki, thank you so much for that call. And I related so hard to that because about 3 weeks ago, my wife and I bought a bird feeder and we hung it up on the front porch. And for the last 3 weeks, we have just been staring out the window watching birds. And I swear, 75% of the birds that land on this feeder, I could not tell you what kind of bird that is. And I feel like totally inadequate. So it sounds like this whole idea of like slowing down and learning more about the nature around us can actually really teach us something.
Yeah, I think it can teach us something, and I think it can also, I mean, what's great about that caller's story is like sort of giving yourself permission to just explore this thing that's happening around you and give yourself the break, because we all need that break. There's so much pressure right now to be up on everything and to be as productive as possible, and it can be a little disastrous when we devote so much time to being productive and efficient that we don't give ourselves these mental breaks. That's why so many people and so many companies are interested in mindfulness and meditation right now. Now, if you don't have time to actually start a mindfulness practice, which does take some effort, perhaps, you can just embrace these moments of, you know, I encourage people to a baby step is like, just go to a window in your house that you've, you know, walked past 3 million times and spend 5 minutes looking at what everything you can see, and then do the same thing the next day and note what changed. And learn to appreciate the power that these kind of small breaks from the hurly-burly can give you and how that can kind of recharge you. And maybe you'll discover, maybe you'll be like this caller and discover, you know, you may not get as lucky to discover like a thriving chipmunk community that you can now tune into, but I think that kind of thing is terrific.
We're talking to Rob Walker right now about his book, The Art of Noticing, which explores why taking time to pay attention helps us become more present and more creative.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you found it difficult to pay attention in your daily life? Have you found a solution that you'd like to share? How do you slow down and appreciate the world around you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation with journalist Rob Walker about his new book, The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself or your loved ones glued to your phones or other devices? How do you pull away? Do you make time in your day for reflection, for rejuvenation, or focus into your daily routine? We'd love to hear from you right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Rob, as you mentioned before, you're not asking for anyone to go on a digital detox, but one thing that you suggest that people can do is, okay, go to your favorite social media channels, read your feed, that's fine, but that's it. Don't contribute, don't comment, just read. What do you see as the benefit in that?
Yeah, well, I think I position that as it's analogous to the vow of silence that monks take. And I think sometimes, this isn't maybe for everybody, but we get a little too caught up in feeling that we need to express every single thing that occurs to us and sort of perform, and not, it's very similar to the way in conversation, a lot of people aren't really listening. They're just waiting for their turn to speak, and they're not really taking in what they're hearing. So it's a good exercise to try to have a little discipline from time to time and really try to understand, and especially try to understand points of view. I hate to delve into politics per se, but you know, maybe to understand points of view that are not your natural point of view, and to really try to devote time to quietly understanding where someone else is coming from.
And in that vein, you write in the book about listening selflessly, that not jumping mm-hmm. into the conversation and not needing to contribute your two cents is one of the greatest gifts you can give to another person. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I think that we've all had the experience of having a conversation. Let's say you've been on a first date. Have you ever been on a first date?
I have, yes.
Has anyone ever been on a bad date? So the essence of a bad date is what? It's the other person didn't listen to you. Like, that's the constant thing. So if you can give someone it is a gift to really give attention to what another person is saying. And I have to say, I mentioned teaching. My students are the ones who got me thinking about this as an aspect of attention, because I give them an assignment every year to practice paying attention, to invent an exercise. And I noticed that some of them were giving a lot of exercises that had to do with other people, which wasn't necessarily what I was thinking about in the class, because it's a design class. So I was thinking about visuals and the built environment and so on. But I think they're really onto something, that one of the things that we neglect in our, you know, constantly paying attention to what's coming through on the phone is the people who are around us. And if you can give someone, if you can convince someone that you're really listening and give the signal and really listen to them, people have a lot to say, and they'll say interesting things to you as long as they think you're really paying attention.
We're talking right now with Rob Walker. He is the author of The Art of Noticing, and we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And we'll go to the phones now. Kim is with us in Cross Plains. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What did you want to say, Kim?
Well, I wanted to suggest to your listeners that they should consider drumming with a regular Remo buffalo head drum. I just facilitated a drumming with 30 clinical people, doctors, psychologists. So this is catching on, and now there is research and proof that says everything that us drummers have known for decades, which is that it calms us down, it boosts the immune system, it lowers our stress. And after, I mean, you can spend anywhere from $30 for a simple buffalo head drum to $300, but it's a really nice, non-invasive way to have something, a tool, right away. I just used it the other day. I was all stressed out. I pulled over, I grabbed my drum, and I took 15 minutes, and I was a new girl.
Kim, thank you so much for that call. And I love that, because drumming seems like the perfect combination of making music and banging on things, which is a wonderful combination. Rob, how does music factor into what you're talking about here?
I think that this it's a good example of how we're kind of craving these breaks from the distractions around us. And the main music thing that I bring up is it has to do with sort of deep listening, but the most maybe ironic one is I recommend this famous composition called 4:33 by John Cage, which is actually 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. And I recommend performing that, which anyone can do. You don't need a drum. You just have to be quiet for 4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Which is a lot longer than you would think, right?
It is a lot longer than you would think. And it's a nice exercise, but it's also, I actually do this in my home office on a regular basis because it's fun to just kind of listen to the sounds of the neighborhood. It's a nice centering break, a pause that kind of lets me refocus and recalibrate and just ignore all the stimulus for just 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And what the composer John Cage was trying to do was exactly this. He was drawing this line between, or making us question the line between, what is music, what is noise, what is silence. And instead of thinking of silence as the absence of something, think of it as an invitation to something and see if you can explore it. And you can do that anywhere where you have 4 minutes and 33 seconds. It's a nice break.
And speaking of recalibrating, we have Sarah on the phone in Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Yeah, I've recalibrated. I retired this winter, and I love my flower gardens and vegetable gardening. I just love it. But I never was caught up. I was always running behind, and I was always stressed. And this spring, I have enjoyed my gardening so much, just being laid back gardening, let it just happen. And I'm really enjoying it. And I have to laugh because the other day I was using my favorite wheelbarrow. It's very old and rusty, and unfortunately it's going to fall apart any day. And I just realized at some point that wheelbarrow had been used by my father's family on their, or my husband's family on their farm for three generations. And all of a sudden I was wandering off in thought, kind of respecting all the work that all these people did with this wheelbarrow.
Sarah, thank you so much for that that call. And yeah, that sort of epiphany that comes from doing something that does take attention and time, but also allows you to really, really focus.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have had that maybe any other way, right?
There's like two things there. One is the sort of discovery of the story within something, that there are so many stories around us that if we just stop and think about it, that we can kind of explore and learn and reflect on and feel good about, as this caller did. And also, the book actually ends on the note of the connection between taking, you know, she mentioned gardening, taking care of something and attention, and how those don't immediately seem like connected ideas, but if you think about it, they're completely intertwined, that we should really pay attention to what we care about and care about what we pay attention to. And just that simple thought can be really productive and centering and lead to good things.
And briefly, Rob, as we wrap up, leave us with one thing that we can do tonight. Perhaps we're going home to a partner or a friend or a family member. What's something we can do with someone at home that'll really just bring us closer together?
Oh, well, I think that here's one. I'm always, because a lot of people have children at home, children are kind of an inspiration in a lot of ways in terms of looking creatively at the world. Try, even if, whether you have kids or don't have kids, try to spend a little time experiencing your world as a child might, because while you may be jaded and you've seen it all, you know how if you've been around kids, they're excited by the most workaday things and turn everything into a game. Try to take some inspiration from a child tonight.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was columnist and journalist Rob Walker. We talked to him about his new book, The Art of Noticing.
Tall stacks of pancakes, scrambled eggs, sausages, coffee, juice, cheese curds. You'll find all that and more at breakfast on the farm events around the state.
There's one in each of Wisconsin's 72 counties this time each year, and thousands of people gather at family farms to eat, socialize, and learn about life on the farm and the dairy industry.
Last year, though, was tough for dairy farmers as milk prices plummeted and ate into their profits. In fact, some farmers got out of the business entirely. That's part of the reason why this year's dairy breakfast in La Crosse County almost didn't happen. But for many farmers across the state, it's a tradition worth holding on to.
Julie Bosman is a national correspondent for the New York Times who covers the Midwest. She was also born and raised in Wisconsin and attended the breakfast in La Crosse County a couple of weeks ago. Her recent piece for the Times is Farms Have Folded, But the Dairy Breakfast Must Go On. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So for those who haven't been to a dairy breakfast, what happens at one of these events?
Well, they start very, very early, as the name implies, and as the tradition goes, a different farm hosts the dairy breakfast every year, and they start around 6 a.m., and there's usually a long line of people who show up at a farm and get in line to eat an incredibly wonderful spread of food, very heavy emphasis on the dairy. Usually there's eggs and cheese and pancakes and, of course, ice cream for breakfast. And I think it's one of those events that happens every year and people really count on it, and food really brings people together, but it's also a celebration of a tradition and of an industry that people really share.
Yeah, I remember being a city kid and growing up in the Chicago area, and we would occasionally make the trip to Wisconsin, and we went to these dairy breakfasts, and that was really my only exposure to farms. Is that part of the appeal of these events, is that it connects people from the cities to where their food comes from?
I think it does still really play that role. It seemed to me, just from talking to a lot of people at the dairy breakfast in La Crosse, is that people were in kind of two different groups. If you were an older person, you generally had a direct tie to a farm at some point in your life. You either grew up on a farm or your parents did, or maybe you still farmed. And then there were the younger people who brought their little kids and, you know, went to the bounce house and the petting zoo area of the farm and wanted to show their kids where their food came from and, you know, what a cow is and that milk comes from a cow and all these things that kids who have no connection to agriculture in a direct way need to know. So I think everyone was kind of sharing in the same ritual, but for different reasons. And that was kind of my experience growing up. My grandparents were dairy farmers, so I grew up around dairy farms. And it was very important to go to the dairy breakfast that I could learn even more about what agriculture is.
You went to the La Crosse County Dairy Breakfast, an event that almost didn't happen. And, I mean, this is all happening amidst a backdrop of dairy farms having a tough time of it right now with milk prices pretty low. How important is it for the farmers that you've heard from that these events go on in face of that economic hardship?
So it was very interesting what happened in La Crosse this year. There's a committee that runs the breakfast, and by the time March of this year rolled around, they realized that they could not find a single farmer who was willing to host the breakfast and really had the bandwidth to host the breakfast. It's a huge undertaking, and it takes a lot of effort, and a lot of community groups pitch in, but you still have to make your farm look extra nice, and you have to deal with the logistics of having literally thousands of people show up at your farm in the span of a few hours. So it was very difficult in La Crosse. They've lost a bunch of dairy farms just in the last year, and they really couldn't find anyone. So what happened was the committee took a vote in March, and the only person who voted to keep the breakfast was Louisa Peterson, who is a dairy farmer in La Crosse, and she said, look, I will host the breakfast. My family and the other family that owns the farm with us will do this. So they were committed to doing it, and I think that they just weren't willing to let this tradition die. They thought, you know, we need to show people that the dairy industry is still strong, that there are still good things happening. And even though this is a huge undertaking, we are willing to do it for 2 years in a row.
And even though, you know, perhaps it's getting harder to find a farmer to host one of these breakfasts, did you get the sense from being at this event that attendance was pretty much where it's always been?
I thought attendance was really incredible. You know, it's mostly a rural county, of course, and, you know, the city of La Crosse is nearby. But to have 3,500 people show up, and that was actually more people than showed up last year, is really just a jaw-dropping thing. And it's a reflection of how much this means to people. And even though, you know, no one had to be there, and it's very, very early in the morning, you still have this incredible enthusiasm for this tradition. And over, I saw people going up to Louisa Peterson and hugging her and holding her hand and saying, thank you for doing this, and thank you for stepping up and keeping this going.
We are talking right now with Julie Bosman. She is a national correspondent for the New York Times who covers the Midwest, and we are talking about the tradition of the dairy breakfast. And Julie, I know you just focused on this one county in La Crosse on that dairy breakfast, but did you get the sense from those that you've talked to that this is an issue that's not just you know, delegated to La Crosse County, that farmers all across Wisconsin might be dealing with some of the same issues?
Yeah, I think that the issues that farmers are dealing with in La Crosse County are pretty similar to what dairy farmers are facing across the state. Like you mentioned, the price of milk has gone down. It's very, very expensive to get into the dairy farming business. It's also very expensive to stay in. And one thing that's pretty unique to dairy farming is just how labor intensive it is. As every dairy farmer knows, you know, you have to get up very early every day, whether it's a beautiful day or whether it's winter or whether it's Christmas morning, you still have to get up and take care of your cows. And I think that that can really wear on people. And when you're barely making enough money to get by and the price of milk keeps going down, there is a very big incentive for a lot of farmers to say, I'm just going to sell my herd. I can't do this anymore. If you have, you know, 20, 25, 30 cows, it's very difficult to stay in the business. So what you're seeing all across the state is farmers selling their herds, and usually those herds are maybe not going far, but being folded into a larger farm nearby.
Did you see at the breakfast that you were at enthusiasm from young people who may have been there? This is a chance to, you know, show off agriculture, show off dairy in particular. Did you get a sense that, you know, perhaps the next generation of farmers were there and possibly getting excited about a career in agriculture?
I did. I talked to one young woman in particular, and she was a member of the family. Her great-grandfather started the farm. Her name was Megan Hansen, and she was a 21-year-old who is studying dairy science at the University of Wisconsin. And she spoke very eloquently and very firmly about her desire to go into the farming business. She said, you know, I want to be a farmer. I want to go into agriculture. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. Maybe I'm going to start study nutrition. Maybe I'm going to, you know, tackle another aspect of the industry. But she was very enthusiastic about dairy's future, and it was also just very cool to see her go around the farm and help deliver a calf and feed the calves, and she just knew her way around, and she had really grown up with it as well.
And so for someone who has never been to one of these events before, let's talk about the food. I mean, we're talking pancakes, we're talking sausage, there's often ice cream involved. I mean, it sounds like it's a real feast when you go to one of these events. Is that what you found?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, that is really the one of the things that draws people, and you can count on more food than you can possibly imagine. But I was especially struck at the La Crosse Dairy Breakfast by just the tools that they used. They had these enormous pans to scramble eggs in that looked like, you know, they must have been used in, you know, an army barracks or something, just to, you know, they were using dust pans to stir the eggs because they couldn't use a regular spatula. They had those great rotating griddles for pancakes and just a huge buffet. The pans of eggs could actually make about 200 eggs in each batch, and it was going constantly for about 5 hours. So it's a huge, huge, great meal. And I think Culver's was there handing out bowls of frozen custard starting at 6 a.m. So I really endorse ice cream for breakfast.
I mean, anytime you can start your day with cheese curds and a bowl of custard, I feel like it's a good day. Am I right?
Why not? Yes.
Yeah. Well, Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was nice talking with you.
You too. Julie Bosman is a national correspondent for the New York Times who covers the Midwest. And we talked with her about the popularity and importance of Wisconsin dairy breakfasts, even as dairy farms around the state go under. And if you have a dairy breakfast memory to share, tweet us at Central Time WPR and tell us your story. For Americans and Wisconsinites living below the poverty line, there are a number of federal and state proposals in the mix that could significantly impact their status and their ability to improve it.
Tim Smeeting is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's also the co-author of a new report on poverty in Wisconsin, and that report came out this week from the UW Institute for Research on Poverty. Tim, thanks for joining us again on Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start big and then go small. Let's look at the federal level and what's currently happening within the Trump administration. What is happening currently, I guess, that it's looking to redefine poverty?
Well, the Trump administration has decided, I think, that they're going to get rid of all needs-based programs. And there are a lot of ways of doing that. One is to put a lot of administrative burdens on people who apply. Another one is to define poverty away. And there are a number of areas in which they're working at this, food programs, health insurance programs, abortion, even voting is heavily driven, and certainly immigration policy and treatment, particularly of children born in this country who come from parents who weren't born in this country. That's 20% of the poor, according to a recent National Academy of Sciences report that my colleagues and I turned out.
When you talk about administrative burdens being placed on these people, can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. The rules and regulations and access to programs. A good example was cutting people off of Medicaid in Arkansas because they didn't report what they needed to report on time, or they didn't meet work requirements. The New England Journal of Medicine last week published a thorough report which showed that reduced work. It didn't increase work. It actually reduced work. So it's the opposite of what they wanted. And a lot of people got a lot sicker because they didn't have access to health care. So workfare programs like that, and one that we're going to be doing in our state in the fall for families with the youngest children of school age for SNAP. Those programs aren't going to work. Our National Academy of Sciences report said that they didn't work. Just forcing people to go to work isn't going to help. You need to help people so they want to go to work. You need work supports and income supports.
And these work requirements have been put in place in various states. We know that they've been put in place here. They've been placed not necessarily at the federal level, but it seems like work requirements, that might be a more blanket thing that comes down the pipe from this administration. What, I guess, broadly would that do if we're seeing it not work on a state level?
Well, it would spread the effects to other states and other people. Certainly it failed in the Farm Bill, but we had already implemented what was in the Farm Bill. If the Farm Bill had passed, we'd have gotten some money to help implement the workfare that we put in, and we would have been a little bit better off. But in the rest of the country, they wouldn't have been. There's this idea that anything that aims to feed people or house people or give them health care is somehow welfare. And therefore, they shouldn't have access to it, even if the law says that they should. And so there's all sorts of attempts to make it more difficult to get the programs or to define the need itself away.
You know, part of what the conversation about poverty typically entails is both public opinion and opinion that comes from the government, whether it's the state government or the federal government. It seems as though it's not always at odds between the public and an administration. I'm not saying that, you know, there's broad support for these measures, but there are plenty of people that say, I go to work, I have a job, and I get X, Y, Z. How do we have a conversation that talks about poverty and how it impacts everyone, not just families living in it?
That's a great question. We need to talk about how we're leaving people behind in this state. We're leaving a number of people behind and nationally about how, suppose that you want people to work in the market, and I want them. I think the long-term solution for most people is a good job that pays enough. But that means you have to invest in health and healthcare so they're healthy. You have to invest in their education so that they're more capable of working. When you have a single parent, they need work supports. There are a number of things. Let me give you an example of three things that didn't happen yesterday, which you're going to talk about in your next half hour, which should. Number one, everyone loves the earned income tax credit, at least conservatives and liberals that I know. And there's a lot of pressure to increase it at the federal level to include single people. We threw the state, the Evers proposal for an increased state earned income tax credit out. 34, 35, have raised the minimum wage above 7 1/4. We haven't. We didn't consider that. I'm not talking about $15. That wouldn't be good. But 10 or 10.50, there is an incentive to go out and work. And the third thing, of course, is Medicaid expansion, which 37 other states have already taken advantage of, which only makes sense in terms of helping people get back to work by controlling their opioids. It helps expand benefits to the elderly who we show their high health care costs are pushing them into poverty. It would help broaden services for families and children. Those are three things that would help people do more work, do the right thing, and therefore escape poverty. And we didn't do any of them this past week.
We're talking to Tim Smeeding right now. He is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. And we're talking about poverty. We're taking a pretty broad look. And Tim, you were the co-author of a study, if we're going to take a look at Wisconsin, that found that poverty more or less has remained stagnant in the state. It's at around 10 or 11%. It's not getting bigger, but it's not getting smaller. Is that a surprise for you as someone who studies this?
It is something of a surprise, and it's related to some of the things we said before. So as we found in the National Academy report, and when you look at Wisconsin, you know, work alone is not enough. But here we are in the data 8.5 years, and next week 10 years into a recovery. Everyone talks about 2.9% unemployment rate. People are working more. They're working more hours. But the actual rate of pay in a number of low-wage occupations, caregiving, janitors, retail sales, food preparation, is lower in real terms now than it was in 2002. So what you find is work alone is not enough to get out of poverty. So even though people are working more, and then the safety net is cutting back at the same time. And we need that. You need some income supports and you need work supports. Child care is a perfect example. You're going to need child care if you want single mothers to work. Everyone understands this. How exactly we go about doing it, we don't know. But if you're going to say you have to work 30 hours a week or you lose your SNAP benefits, and, well, I need before and after school care. I need summer care. I'm going to need maybe some transportation help. At $7.25 an hour, it doesn't make sense for me to go to work. So there are all sorts of things that would support income and support work. And the combination together is what helps reduce poverty, to make a dent.
And where exactly are we seeing this concentration of poverty in the state?
Oh, in the state, it's this year there was a spot that popped up in Eau Claire and Chippewa and bounced up a little bit. Everyone has asked me why. I don't know why.
It's one of those things that seems
But Milwaukee is there, and it's always there. And partly it has to do with race. Partly it has to do with formerly incarcerated. It's to do with violence. If our major city, if we can't do anything in our major city, we're not going to get far. We need to help people get engaged in the job market. We need employers to go out and give opportunities to people the way the Just Bakery does here in Madison, for instance. We need to improve the schools for kids. There's all sorts of things that we need to do if we're going to fight poverty, particularly child poverty. And we have to do something about Milwaukee as a state.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the federal poverty level is something like $25,000 for a family of four. I'm give or take maybe a couple hundred dollars. But do we need to rethink how we define poverty? Because it will probably broaden who's in that zone if we actually take that into account. The cost of living is quite high.
Of course. That poverty line was something that was invented in 1960. And has only been priced up since. It was almost half of the median family's income when it was introduced. Now it's below 30%. And if what the administration is trying to do is to take a deflator, a really fast deflator, which says that that's worth, you know, that you can really buy a lot with $25,000 and reduce it even further, the actual poverty line. All of that is just going to make the problem worse. This is why if you come to our state or other states, the guidelines that allow you access to programs like, let's say, child care, 185% of the poverty line. Medicaid for kids, 185%. 130% for SNAP. People realize that the poverty line is just too low. If we use the supplemental poverty line, that's $2,000 or $3,000 higher. That's a little better. That's based exactly on, like the Wisconsin Poverty Report, on what people spend, low-income people spend. That's a better measure than what we have.
This feels like such a complicated and widespread issue. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. But Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jay. See.
That's Tim Smeeting. He's the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the state of poverty in Wisconsin and how federal and state proposals could affect people living on low incomes statewide. And we'll continue this conversation as more news comes out.
Researchers at St. Andrews University in Scotland have trained seals to do something a little unique.
That's a gray seal named Zola mimicking pretty closely the Star Wars theme song.
The researchers at St. Andrews are using the seals to shine light on how speech develops, and we're pretty impressed by the seals' ability to hear and relay tones. And JC, I'm really impressed by your ability to keep it together on the air.
I really tried. I've only watched that video probably about 15 times to prep in order to not laugh on the air, but it is pretty cool the way that research looks into really similar, you know, they're looking into speech patterns and whether or not other animals can mimic what we do. We see it in other things like parrots, but
yeah.
Seals? Would never have thought.
And, you know, my thing is, like, if you let scientists do anything, they will find a way to work Star Wars into it somehow. So
that is true.
Why not do it with seals and have them replicate the song? So now I'm waiting for the follow-up where they do the Imperial March.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not
I can
even
only
try
imagine
on
how
air.
That would sound. Yeah, I was mostly impressed that the seals sounded better than I would if I had to sing the Star Wars theme. So good on them and good on the folks at St. Andrews University.
Okay, science, get on the Imperial March. We're waiting for
it. Yeah, ready. TikTok.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.